Sorry. Don't give me a heart attack.
You're a great job for saying.
Logging in on Teams.
Morning, everybody. Morning, everybody.
Whatever you want, Pete, this is, we have no. Yeah, whatever the chair, whatever Valerie.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
I now call to order the September 30th special meeting of the Audit Oversight Committee at 9:03. Except as provided by law, no action or discussion shall be taken on any item not appearing on today's agenda. The Oversight Committee encourages public participation. If you wish to speak on an agenda item, please do so during the general public comment period. Public comments may also be submitted electronically by emailing response@ocgov.com. As a reminder, please be aware that there are not at this meeting, or is it, microphones? Okay. As a reminder, please be aware that there are microphones throughout the rooms to record the meeting. Please try to keep aside conversations to a minimum. When you are speaking, please turn your mic on.
Oh, this part we don't.
Yeah. With that, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Thank you. Please indicate your presence when I call your name. Yvonne Rowden.
Present.
Tim Johnson. Supervisor Doug Chafee.
Jesus for proxy.
Katrina Foley.
Nick Annis, proxy for Supervisor Foley. I gave my form up here.
Michelle Aguirre.
Kim Schiff, no proxy.
Drew Atwater. Mark Willey.
Here.
Larry Himmel.
Present.
Okay, and I will note that we do have a quorum for the record. I also want to do a little housekeeping. The restrooms are outside these doors, and the super secret code, if you need to get in, is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Can you repeat that?
Oh, and I guess women's has a pound sign at the end. Sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, pound. Okay.
Aggie's going to have a finding on that.
I could do 3 digits. 4.
Thank you. I'll turn it back to the chair.
Okay. At this time, we will take public comments from any members of the public wishing to speak on an agenda topic or other topics under the subject matter jurisdiction of the committee. Are there any members of the public here today who would like to speak? At this time, committee members may make announcements, comments, request information, give direction to staff, or suggest future agenda items. Do any of my colleagues on the committee have any comments? Okay, then we will now move on to the agenda items for today. Madam Clerk, would you please read the first item?
Item one is an overview of new county procurement policies and controls.
So I'm Kim Ingleby. I'm the CFO for the County of Orange. And today I brought in our chief procurement officer, our county procurement officer. She oversees the procurement for the entire county. And she is going to present the requested information. I believe we're going to be covering all the changes we've made to our procurement practices to secure, to enhance our controls over our procurement process since, I think, 2019 on, I think, is the last time. She'll be covering that. She's fabulous, and you will be amazed by all the things that she's doing. First, she's going to be mastering the art of
F5.
Just not a clicking
hit F5, and it'll come up to the whole thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Grusa. I'm the County Procurement Officer. I've been in this role for 5 years. I've been in government contracting for 25 years. I was first with Raytheon for 7 years, working on defense contracting. I've been with the county for 19 years in 5 departments. I was named County Procurement Officer of the Year by CSAC in 2021 for our COVID efforts, in 2023 for our alliance efforts. I'm the Vice President of CAPO, the California Association of Public Procurement, and I am on the boards for NACO and NIGP, which is the National Institute of Public Procurement. So this is my life, as exciting as it seems. Bye. I oversee the 200 deputy purchasing agents across the 22 county departments. We represent approximately 80% of the board agenda items. And in 2024, we executed 47,000 transactions totaling $5.8 billion. So a lot of effort. What I didn't mention here was that we represent over 50% of the PRAs, and we are the most audited of all functions. Every procurement, right, every contract, all of the federal funding and state funding. We are nationally recognized by NACO for our community and economic development. We have received several other recognition from various organizations. So what I wanted to go over today is the procurement reform. When I got the job 5 years ago, Michelle and Frank challenged me with the assignment of procurement reform. We were decentralized, and all 22 departments' procurement and contracting looked completely different. So we have been working on procurement reform for those 5 years. I'm going to go over it in these three kind of buckets: infrastructure, governance, and then culture. So first is infrastructure. Like I said, we reorganized, centralized. The board approved the, oh, next slide. It's okay. The board approved centralization in January 2025. We just recently completed that centralization effective July 1st, 2025. All departments, with the exception of sheriff, DA, and assessor, are all reporting through the County Procurement Office. We are hoping to achieve standardization and consistency, like I said before, across all departments. We are also maximizing resources and really focusing on succession planning for our future procurement staff. Another piece of the infrastructure that we've been really focused on is system enhancements and automation. We have gone completely paperless over the last 5 years. We implemented DocuSign. We implemented our first contract management system through OpenGov, an asset management system, a grant management system. The funding for all of the system enhancements was through a grant that we received post-COVID. So we had some FEMA findings, and that was lack of ability to collaborate amongst our 22 departments as well as our 34 cities and special districts. So we were awarded a grant to help us in that area. So it was really great. We've implemented all of those systems. Next slide. So by centralizing the staff and centralizing the systems, we've been able to more easily conduct compliance reviews. We have access to all of the documentation from our central office instead of having to go do these visits, ask for these massive files and go through paper. We can do that utilizing the more automated systems. And the really exciting thing that I wanted to discuss today is our regional collaboration. Like I said, one of our FEMA findings was that we were not collaborating across our 22 departments and 34 cities. So the board tasked us, Supervisor Foley was our biggest champion of this, tasked us with initiating an alliance with our 34 cities and special districts. So we did that about 3.5 years ago, and we've been meeting quarterly since. It's gained so much recognition across the region that we are now the SoCal Procurement Alliance, and we have 80 agencies with us. We meet quarterly, we collaborate in contracting, we meet with suppliers, we hold events. It's really great. We've generated over $20 million in new supplier sales through our alliance over the last 3.5 years. So Really exciting project there that came out of COVID. Some good things. This is what our organization looks like now. It's hard to see. I know you have these in front of you, but we split all departments into two. One is the infrastructure and government. Oh, thanks. Infrastructure and government services. The other one's public protection departments. These are our the electeds that are not in the reorganization, and these are kind of all of the corporate programs, compliance systems, professional development, and so on. Governance. Oh, please stop me if I'm going too fast. I tend to just
let me ask a question here. We've got some of them that are outside of the pond, the sheriff's, DA's, and the assessor's office. I know that they're separate elected, so they could do, they have a different plan than we might have. Is there any thoughts or plans to have them integrated into the overall system?
We haven't really, we've really been focused on the other departments right now. It's so new. I think we wanted to really get through that first. But I do want to mention that the DPAs, the deputy purchasing agents that are assigned to those departments, they're also required to do all the certifications that the centralized departments are required to do. They have to retest every 2 years, have 15 hours of training. They have to follow all of our policies.
But they don't come to your quarterly meetings.
They do. They come to all of our quarterly meetings. They have to as part of their deputization.
Okay.
And we conduct compliance reviews on their work as well. And they're very open and collaborative, the staff that are assigned there. So
we've also got this new software procurement system coming in.
ERP?
Yeah, soon. And are they going to be on that system as well?
So Sal and I have a deal. We are going to integrate into ERP. Well, we are going to go over to the ERP for all the functionality they have. Whatever they're missing, we're going to integrate the systems that we've just implemented into the ERP. So we're kind of just looking at what they have now and seeing, you know, what we're going to move over and what we're going to integrate.
So it's undecided yet.
They're going to be together, yeah. Either we're going all the way over there or they're going to be connected. Okay. Either way, they're going to talk to each other. Sal and I worked together to put all of this in their initial scope years ago.
And if I can add, the reason that centralization went so smoothly is that for years, you were already treating it like a centralized function. As the chief county procurement officer, you're responsible for all procurements regardless of if they're elected or not. So she was having the quarterly meetings. If somebody is not complying with the rules, she has the ability still to take their DPA license, certification away. So we were treating it like a centralized function. And by having it centralized now, we have the ability to fill vacancies faster because she handles all the recruitments now for all the procurement. Now we have consistency across all the departments. And then we can also see ways that we can leverage resources.
It's just I see in the county, in these three departments, sometimes we have difficulty getting compliance. And this one, we kind of, it forces compliance because we're not going to pay their bills if they don't follow the system. So that was kind of more of the question.
Okay, governance. Now we'll talk about our policies and procedures. So we actively update our policy manual. It's usually annually or biannually. It goes to the board. The largest recent changes to the contract policy manual was the addition of human services, design and construction, real estate, and MOUs. Those were not included in the contract policy manual. They were kind of standalones. So we've incorporated them all into the contract policy manual now. Some other enhancements are we now are required, we added a lot of contract monitoring policy into the contract policy manual to move towards monitoring performance evaluation and outcomes throughout the life of the contract instead of just at renewal and expiration. So that's been a big change policy-wise. We've also implemented some policy on due diligence. So at contract award and at renewal season, staff now run an extensive due diligence on nonprofits, suppliers, anyone receiving county funds. That goes through Dun & Bradstreet, the Secretary of State, Attorney General, SAM, which feeds into the IRS, I think we learned, and also extensive reference checks. So that was not previously policy. We were only doing Dun & Bradstreet and kind of Attorney General and Secretary of State when red flagged, but now it's done every time, no matter the dollar amount. We've also enhanced our preference programs to include subcontractors qualifying the primes for local small business and disabled veteran preference. So the community was very excited about that. They had been long waiting that. We had many phone calls. I'm sure the board offices did too. Contract policy enhancements that were statute driven. Those were exciting. We had the Levine Act, which required reporting by county contractors of any campaign contributions. We do that through supplier self-reporting at contract award and renewal. Same with the government code 25043, which is disclosure of known familiar relationships. We run that through supplier self-reporting through the procurement process. The one that's been a little more labor intensive was the government code 26227.5. And that is reporting requirements for all nonprofit awards by the Board of Supervisors, regardless of the dollar amount, if the board is giving any kind of gift or monetary gift or sponsorship to a nonprofit, that goes to the board for approval, as well as it goes on a quarterly report that's placed on our website. And that is, like I said, statute driven, so we are required to adhere to that. Okay, some other operational enhancements. All board discretionary sponsorship, event, and procurement expenditures have now all been centralized through County Procurement Office. Some of the departments were in charge of various aspects of that. Events was at OCCR, healthcare had some human service stuff. So now by bringing it all together, there's a lot more visibility. We can kind of track things and ensure adherence a little easier. Okay, we published our first procurement procedures manual about 3 years ago. That's a riveting 500-page document if you ever want to read it. It is a step-by-step guide for procurement professionals and end users if they're curious to see every step of the procurement process, each of the procurement types. We've revised our CalCard limits recently because of the state fixed asset and micro-purchasing limits. So we did that in collaboration with Sal and Auditor Controller. We have also, like I said earlier, we've now put a focus on contract administration. So I kind of talked about that earlier. Contractor performance management, when I was talking about all the systems we implemented, if you ever want to check it out, it's called ProCurated. It's embedded into our contract management system. It's a Yelp for government contractors. So if you go on there, you can kind of see their stars. It looks just like Yelp. You can see their stars and you can see their ratings from our organization and other government entities that have used these suppliers. So I just think that's pretty cool. But contractor non-compliance procedures, that was also a board directive. We now track any non-compliance. So any potential breach letters or anything of the sort is now tracked on a quarterly report that's published to the board. And we have now expanded our focus on external funding sources. We are developing standardized procedures for single audit, risk assessments, and financial oversight. I know Aggie loves risk assessment. And culture, the last but most important, we have been focused on our culture. We have a lot of communications go out. We have a weekly Monday message newsletter communicating with all 200 of procurement professionals on any policy changes, procedures, anything of that sort. We have bi-monthly leadership and all hands meetings. We have annual surveys that go out. We have a anonymous tip or anonymous suggestion box that the procurement professionals can kind of type into without worrying about if anyone knows who submitted it. And we have a really in-depth procurement professionals program like Kim was talking about. They're required to get 15 hours of training annually and re-certify every 2 years. It also requires an intense ethics training given by Dina, our ethics officer. It's a really great training, and they all DPAs are required to take that every 2 years. We have a formalized national mentorship program, and that is it's a cool program. They can pick a mentor within the county, or they can pick the procurement officer of Buffalo, New York. Like, you know, we have access to all of the procurement professionals across the nation. We also have a formalized internship program. We've worked with the Cal State and UC system on their MPA programs. There's a lot of interest in government contracting. So we're partnered with them. We have a pool of probably 150 potential interns that we share with the cities and special districts. So that's a really exciting program. And again, this is our alliance and our supplier and community engagement program. We're really trying to collaborate with our suppliers instead of playing good cop, bad cop. It's been a lot more successful. We have a monthly vendor information day, and we open up, I think, this room to vendors. We usually have between 15 and 30 vendors come. We have the Small Business Association and some of our cities come and attend to talk to potential suppliers. We have our annual supplier engagement event that is at the Anaheim Convention Center. That's attended by approximately 1,500 members of the public, 250 supplier exhibitors, and about 80 public agencies. So that's been a really great event. We have initiated supplier focus groups based on industries. So we have a human service focus group where the nonprofits come in and kind of discuss the barriers in government contracting and doing business with us. We attend partner events, Chamber of Commerce events, Small Business Association events to really expand our partnership. And we have annual supplier surveys. We were published in SCAG, the Southern California Association of Governments, for our efforts in equity in government contracting. We did a study on the cost to procure. So it costs somewhere between $11,000 to $25,000 to run low bid solicitation, and anywhere between $25,000 and $50,000 to run a request for proposal. So each time we're doing one of those, just keep that in mind. And so we are leading an economic impact of government contracting. So now we're working with SCAG on kind of putting a number to what our impacts are of the awarded contracts. We have an interesting number on the next slide. These are just the critical facts I've kind of already gone over, but my favorite is this. Like I said, we're doing a new study, and we've discovered that there were approximately 21,700 jobs created through the contracts that the county has let in the last year. So I thought that was a fun fact. That's it. Be kind to your procurement professionals. They are scrutinized every day on all of their work. So that's it. Any questions?
So are you... Do you report to the CEO's office, or do you report? So you're part of the chief financial officer. Okay, great.
Statistics. That was really a cool number. The 21,000 jobs. Yeah. So that's just 21,000 jobs in the nonprofit or private sector, not including any county.
No, that's not even inclusive of the county.
Right. Those are
jobs,
outside.
Right. Yeah.
That's great.
I did have a question. Could you touch again on the compliance monitoring and staffing? The only reason why I'm referencing that is because, so back in April 2025, right, there was a county procurement audit completed, and a lot of the observations, or some of the observations it made, reference either a lack of staffing for monitoring contracts or lack of training for some of the staff. So I know when that audit was being conducted, the centralization of the procurement staff was taking place, and also with the newer ERP system, that would also contribute to that. But I was just wondering how that addressing it.
Yeah, we had a wave of retirements in that right at that time period that kind of wiped out the county procurement office. We're in the middle of centralization. We had some exciting news that caused a lot of audits to happen in our office, so we're very busy responding to a lot of audits, a lot of PRAs. We had the media like asking us things daily, and our internal compliance program kind of had to take a pause for a month or two. And we're now rebuilt. We've kind of, actually, this is exciting. I forgot to mention this. Exciting to me, procurement geek. The compliance program used to be we would go to one department per month and, you know, go through everything in that department. Now that we're centralized, we thought it would be more effective if we go after one topic per month. So this month, we're looking at all 22 departments' sole sources. So then, you know, if we find any inconsistencies, we can just move towards standardization or training or policy changes right then and there on sole sources. We think that's going to be a more effective way to drive change and improve things. So it's sole sources, RFPs, CalCard. So every month, or, you know, if we're finished quicker, we'll do multiple in 1 month, depending on the topic. But we've kind of shifted to that because it seems more appropriate with the centralization. But we are back up and running full force, Jesus, on turn five.
And you have a dedicated person now, too.
Mm-hmm. We have a dedicated team.
So, Aggie, I wanted to ask how this works. So we're looking at procurement deputies when we're doing our internal audits of a department, right? And what they do, or the results of what they've done. But we don't look at the procurement, we don't do an internal audit of the procurement department itself, do we?
Well, we did, we contracted out a governance one that did look at staffing levels, and that's the report that Assistant Chief of Staff Jesus mentioned, the report that was done, and it did look at staffing levels. It also looked at
But generally when we
salaries
the,
and
but generally when we touch the procurement department, we're cutting it, we're touching it individually at a department, not at
correct,
not at the overall
right
spot.
This audit was a one-off that we did, and we had it our audit plan based on you know, some risks that we had identified that we wanted. Yeah, this
right
was
because there's
the no stuff happened that we eventually yeah. did get to that audit, and they're doing a lot of things right.
Right. Because I'm sure I'd hear out of a heat map from Andrew, we'd talk about how obviously this would be an area that has a lot of heat on it because they do so
oh,
many,
absolutely.
I mean, do so many things. So it might be of interest, you know, on some sort of scheduled basis to look at the overall procurement department.
Absolutely. And now know? That we have performance audit, Mark, thank you for allowing me. That's exactly what the plan is. In the past, we didn't. So we're really limited to just financial and those kinds of controls. But of course, you know, right now they've been looked at. What we'll be doing is doing a follow-up to see if they've implemented the
right. Right, but it's really good when we've got something brand new
oh,
like
absolutely.
This. We take a,
yeah,
and because it appears what's happening a little bit because of the things that they do, they're kind of internal auditing their own deputies, right? So there's a little bit of that kind of going on.
Well, the coastal stuff that you talk about all
yeah.
the time, the self-monitoring, you know, they
self-monitoring,
do an excellent
right.
job of getting out there. Because we're the third line of defense, you know, and they're the second one. They're going out there and they're ensuring that they're doing the compliance with the policies that they have included in the CPM. In the past, there's been too much influence by supervisors in the CPM. But that's changing, and now we're getting, you know, some rules that make sense. And you can see all the enhancements the board made, all the obviously, all the discretionary fund stuff goes before the board for approval. Recently, some other office asked about vacancies related to that same report, and Maria and her team got some information for it. They have 220 total positions countywide. They're down to 27 vacancies, but most of those are in the satellite offices and not in Maria's main central. It's okay if I share this.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's been, I mean, it's related to the audit, right? Their compliance unit has resumed doing audits, as Maria mentioned, but they still have, I think, one vacancy, right, in that unit. So that's kind of the status of where they're. But great question.
Yeah, I think
aligned
it's
with what we're
it's when they've done all this work, we should look at it and see how they've done.
Absolutely.
And my hat's off to you. It's, this is not an easy, thing to do.
We'll be going out on that one. 6 months would be soon, right?
The end of October.
I think. It's, yeah.
That's when the.
Status. Yeah, so there's a lot of interest.
We'll be working on it.
I just wanted to make sure that assistant deputy director position is still vacant.
It is. I'm going to be running a new recruitment on that.
Any more questions or discussion? Excellent overview.
Thank you. Thank you all.
And now we've got
yeah, we're having a leadership workshop.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
We can move on to item number two.
Yes, item two is an overview of the AOC and IOC bylaws, responsibilities, and duties. And we have Senior Deputy County Counsel Ronnie Magsaysay to provide the overview.
Good morning, everyone. So the bylaws are really the rules approved by the Board of Supervisors that govern the committee. It outlines the purpose of the committee, discusses the requirements for membership, the roles and responsibilities, how the meetings are run, the powers of the chair and vice chair. So it's really the governing document for the committee. The purpose of the committee is really to advise the Board of Supervisors on all matters related to county audits, the board's authority to audit various departments and financial matters in the counties derived by the Government Code 25303. This committee acts on behalf of the board in assisting in reviewing those audits. I mean, there's hundreds of audits that come through the county internal audits, financial audits, performance audits. Your purpose is to review those reports and ensure that corrective action is taken where necessary, and then advise the board where they need to be advised on those. You're really the audit experts for the county, and you know, the board takes that responsibility very seriously. You know, for the public members in particular, you were selected because of your knowledge and expertise. Under the governing resolution and the bylaws, the members are required to possess expertise in finance, business, and accounting with an emphasis on prior audit experience. And the board really trusts this committee. Recently expanded its responsibilities by asking the members to sit as the members of the Investment Oversight Committee. I wanted to just kind of highlight a couple of particular items in the bylaws regarding the AOC's roles and responsibilities. The committee provides oversight over financial statements and reporting to review the quality of the county's financial reporting activities, the ACFR, and that's really, you know, the purpose of today's meeting, to provide some education and background so that you're better equipped to provide that role. You oversee the audit function of the auditor controller, so you review all the mandated audits, the audits required under the government code, the statement of assets at the treasurer's office, of all the various JPAs throughout the county. You review all of those. You oversee the internal audit department, so all the audits focusing on internal controls, performance audit, which, you know, I kind of think of as like the, you know, management consulting audits, you know, where the county can perform better. You review all of those, and those are now under the direction of the internal audit department. And then you make sure that all these audits are properly resolved, and where they're not, you notify the board accordingly. Recently, you know, we held a series of meetings at the Audit Oversight Committee and also various ad hoc committee meetings to update the bylaws to account for the Investment Oversight Committee responsibilities moving under this new committee. Ultimately, those were accepted by the committees, and those will be going to the board for approval on October 14th. Assuming it's approved, then those bylaws, the consolidated bylaws, will govern the two committees. That's just a brief overview of the bylaws. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any on those.
Okay. Item three.
Okay, item three is an overview of the annual comprehensive financial report. And we have Auditor Controller Andrew Hamilton and Financial Reporting and Mandated Cost Unit Manager Susan Munoz, and also David Showalter and Kinnelly Sokasium from I. Bailey to provide the overview.
A panel of experts.
Yes.
Comes in. You may want to say something, but I just want to give a quick little overview. I'm Susan Munoz from the Auditor Controller Financial Reporting and Mandated Cost Unit. We're currently a unit of 10, and beginning in August through December, we start compiling and preparing our ACFR with the assistance of all the county departments. So preparation is not just our unit. We get the assistance from everybody, and they also review our ACFR. We're currently working on our fiscal year 24-25 ACFR, and we're on track to meet our December deadline, hopefully before Christmas. But with that, David and Kinnelly will actually be doing the presentation, and I'll pass it on to them.
Split up the task here. So.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Kinnelly Sukasam, and David and I will be walking you through the overview of the annual comprehensive financial report. So I'm going to do the quick overview, and then David will dive into the details. So the overview of the annual comprehensive financial report, we wanted to first identify what the layout of the ACFR was. So when you're looking through the ACFER,
you're going to need to use your outdoor voice.
There's no.
Or a mic, one of the two.
Okay. I'll project. Is that better? Okay. So one of the things that you'll see is the overview of the ACFER. There are three sections that are contained in the ACFER. So the first section is the introductory section, and this includes the transmittal letter that's prepared by the auditor controller and the chief financial officer, the GFOA certificate of achievement award, and also the county's organizational chart. So the first item, the transmittal letter, is so that's a part of the introductory section, and this includes a profile of the county, certain information used in assessing the economic condition of the county, the reserve and financial policies of the county, but also the organizational structure of the county. The second section that we'll dive into is the financial section. The financial, oh, this is the transmittal.
You just go back to the two table of contents. Sections.
So the second section that I wanted to highlight is called the financial section. And this is the main section of the ACFER, and it includes the following. So the first item that it contains is the independent auditor's results, which is included on page 16 and 19 of the ACFER, the management discussion and analysis, which introduces the financial statements, and also provides an analytical overview of the government's financial activities. In the MD&A, you'll see the prior year and current year comparisons and explanations of variances. Also contained in the section are the government-wide financial statements, which is the government financial statements presented on a full accrual level, the fund financial statements of the governmental, proprietary, and fiduciary fund level statements. So these are, for the governmental funds, these are being prepared on a modified accrual versus the full accrual on the government-wide financial statement. Also in this section is the notes to the financial statements. These are definitely something that you don't want to skip because it provides an understanding of the financial statements. That's not just the numbers. Also contained here is the required supplementary information. This is unaudited, however, we do review the required supplementary information to ensure that it is consistent with the information that is presented in the basic financial statements. And you'll see in the required supplementary information, it's building to a 10-year schedule, but the main goal is to present it as far as 10 years. Also included in this section is the supplementary information. The next page. Yes. Keep going after the RSI. Yes, here's the supplementary information. So this one provides user access to each individual non-major governmental fund and non-major enterprise fund, and then also all of the internal service funds of the county and the fiduciary custodial. The statistical section is the last section of the ACFER. If you keep going down, please. Okay. So this one offers operational, economic, and historical data and provides context for assessing the county's economic condition. Information in this section is also unaudited. And you'll see as you go into the statistical section, it's also a 10-year presentation. The governmental funds are reported using balance sheets and changes in fund balance. So it's measured on a modified accrual. And then the government-wide is on a full accrual. So that's on the economic focus. The MD&A is one of the things that I wanted to point out before I handed this over to David. So that's identified on pages 20 to 39. And again, it's just providing an overview of the financial statements, and the tables there agree with the basic financial statements, but it's just in a consolidated form. And then David will walk us through the wide and on level statements in detail.
So just a real quick recap on what Canale brought you through the table of contents, which has all of the details of what's in your financial statements. I think it's important to point out that this financial statement is, the format of it is promulgated through GASB. So GASB, the Government Accounting Standards Board, provides the format of your financial statements, so the county can't just pick and choose how it wants to prepare its financial statements. It has to follow the accounting guidance that exists for, lots of entities don't issue a comprehensive annual financial report. Some just issue financial statements with their footnotes, but the county does issue the annual report. And so because you do issue an annual report, you have to include all the elements that make up an annual report that the GASB specifies that needs to be included. So you can't pick and choose what you want to add or exclude. So the transmittal letter, that's all required. The statistical section, those two sections are required if you want to have an annual report. The financial section, which starts on page 16, that's where we get involved with the audit. That's what we're interested in, is the financial section, because that is your financial statements. We read the transmittal letter, we read the introductory section, we read the statistical section. There are accounting pronouncements that dictate how that statistical section should be formatted, but we don't opine on that information. So no opinion is given on the intro section, and no opinion is given on the statistical section, but we do opine on most of the elements of the financial section. And I'll go through starting on page 40. So page 40 is really where things begin. So if you can scroll to page, it's not PDF 40, it's gonna be the app for document 40. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
But everybody has their book here. So page 40 begins the financial section. After the opinion, after the management's discussion analysis, this is the beginning of your financial statements. Your financial statements are divided into various sections. You have a government-wide section, and you have fund-level sections. The government-wide is your sort of a representation of what are all of the resources, the assets and liabilities, and the revenues and expenses of the county as a whole, before you get into the different funds that make up the government wide. And then your primary government, is it okay if you can scroll up? That'd be helpful. Sorry
about that, guys.
Yeah, keep on going. Okay, your primary government financial statements are broken up into government activities and business type activities. Okay, so your government-wide statements make up the activities that are governmental in nature. Let's just take your general fund. And your business type activities, which would be things like the airport or your solid waste division. So those make up the two columns that add up to the total. And then on your government-wide statements, we also include component units that are not blended. These are component units that are closely related to the county, but do not meet the requirement to be blended in with the county's financial statements or treated as a fund. And the county has two discreetly presented component units, First 5 OC and Cal Optima. Now, the reason why they're presented as component units is because your board appoints their board, and your board has the ability to remove their board members at will. So there is some financial benefit burden relationship and financial accountability with respect to the governance. So when they meet the requirements under GASB to be included as a component unit, the county goes through the process of determining should it be discreetly presented or blended, and these two are discreetly presented, and so this is where they're reflected in your financial statements. Notice they're not part of your total. They're just sitting on the outside of the total. Okay, so business type activities, government activities, this is your total here for the county as a whole. And then you have these other entities, which you have some financial accountability over, your board does, but notice they're not part of your total. They're just on the outside. They're sitting on the outside.
What page are we looking at here?
40.
40.
Thanks.
Okay, 41. Okay, so 40 is your total assets. You can see this is a balance sheet, assets, liabilities. With the net result is your net position.
62.
Okay, so.
Okay, so it's not 40.
Well.
I didn't think so.
I think 40 in this book.
40 in the report.
Okay.
Sorry.
Not
the ALC meeting. So on page 41, but how this financial statement is different than your fund financial statements is that this financial statement, your government-wide statements, is on a full accrual basis. It is going to include all of your assets, all of your liabilities, whether they're short-term or long-term. They are going to be reflected on this financial statement. many, many years ago, we didn't have this financial statement. GASB 34 came along right around 25 years ago and required that we pick up these capital assets, we pick up the long-term liabilities, and we report on them using this net position or net asset format. So your ending results for the county is that for your governmental activities, you have about $4.7 billion in net position. Your business type have about $1.8 billion in net position. The total of that is about $6.6 billion. Now, net position, the GASB requires that we just don't have one number for net position. GASB requires that we break it up into different categories. Okay, so your net position, kind of similar to even some not-for-profit accounting, we do break it up in some categories. But what we're breaking it up into is three categories. Net investment in capital assets, or used to be net investment in capital assets, net of related debt. Restricted and unrestricted. So your net investment in capital assets is going to be all of your capital assets, which if you go to the previous page, you'll see that that number was about $4.8 billion for government activities. Less the related debt. So the county will issue bonds or issue debt in order to finance the construction of those assets. So that portion of net position is all of your capital assets net of any debt that was issued in order to finance the construction of that. Go to the next page, please. And then the categories are further expanded into restricted. And the GASB does require that you classify those restrictions into different functions or categories. And lastly, what's left over is your unrestricted. In this case, we have a deficit, $1.1 billion for the government activities. And we have a positive $831 million in business type activities with a net unrestricted of $291 million deficit. So you might ask about the deficit. Why do we have a deficit? Because when I look, I have assets of $10 billion. And I have liabilities of $6.4 billion. So I should be in the positive. Again, remember, we have to go through and classify your net position in these different categories. So once we finish classifying it into net investment and capital assets and restricted, we don't have enough left over in the unrestricted, and it results in a deficit. And one of the primary reasons for that deficit, and if you remember, your net investment in capital assets is your capital assets minus the related debt. So we're netting out some liabilities against those assets. If you just look up to the total liabilities of $6.4 billion, and if you just look up two lines above that, you have net pension liability and you have net OPEB liability, okay? Those two liabilities don't have the benefit of having any assets to offset it. They're already offset with assets. in the plan, in the pension plan. This is the net liability. So if you were to drill into that net pension liability or net OPEB liability, you would see total plan assets minus fiduciary net assets minus the total liability. That's what gives us the net liability. So the plan has the assets and there's a liability for the reporters. For the plan participants, you have to report the net pension liability and the net OPEB liability. So that is already net of any assets that the plan has. That's what's causing the majority of this, if not all of your deficit.
So David, this is, we've been in this position since we had to go full accounting on the pensions.
2024.
So we've been in the same position.
2014, excuse me.
2014. So we've been in the same position for 10 years, because this is the 24th.
Yep.
So we've been in this position for 10 years. And as it continued to decrease over that period?
That's a great question. And the financial statements has a great table that shows you the activity of your net pension liability over
and
time.
And you put that in there just for me? Thank you so much, David.
The GASB was already thinking about that for you, Mark.
Okay.
That's on page... That's a great question, and that actually starts on page 164.
It goes for 12 pages.
Document. Look at the bottom, 164. And because we just hit the 10-year mark this last year with GASB 68, we now have a full 10 years of reporting in the schedule. This is a 10-year schedule. So if you go, so on page 164, if you're there, the first schedule, which is the one you want to be interested in, this is the Orange County Employees Retirement System. This is the county's participation in OSERS. And if you look at the 2023 column, that's the column that's the most current for this financial statement. $4,062,000,000 is your liability. You see that. And if you just track that back in time, you can go all the way back to 2014 and see that in 2014, it was $3.8 billion was the liability. And the liability has just sort of stayed fairly consistent until 21. Something happened in 21. The market just went crazy.
Right.
But then it went back to the normal market the year after, and so... So the liability went down pretty significantly in 21, and then it went back up again in 22 because 21 wasn't really reality. It was more COVID-induced market returns. Okay. So this gives you a good profile of the county's position liability. The percentages above it give you your the county's proportion. What that means is that the county is the largest member of OSERS. And so this is your proportionate share of the liability that OSERS values on an annual basis. The county has 83% of that liability. And if you go down to the very bottom, if you go to the bottom of that schedule, last year the plan fiduciary position as a percentage of total net pension liability was about 82%, which is probably not that bad, considering that there's other entities out there that are below 70% or even in the 60% range. So, but you can see that the...
We have about 7 more years before we're fully funded on the pension.
That's
Kim. Yeah, 2030 is our... actually, less than... Our right. Cliff is 2030.
Okay.
Okay. The next set of financial statements that I'm going to go over real quick is starting on page 44 of the financial statements at the bottom. Now, if you recall, the financial statements are divided into the government-wide statements that I just went over with you, full accrual, all of your assets, all of your liabilities are included on those statements. And then starting in page 44, the GASB requires that we have fund financial statements, okay? And the fund financial statements are... just what they are. They're just the operating funds of certain activities within the county. The general fund is the main operating fund of the county. That's a governmental fund. And these financial statements will distinguish between governmental funds. If you look at the heading on the header, governmental funds, and then there we have proprietary funds or business or your enterprise funds as well. The first section are your governmental funds, which primarily is the general fund, and the general fund or the basic financial statements of the governmental funds include a balance sheet and an income statement. Balance sheet is what it says. It's a balance sheet. So total assets equal total liabilities plus fund balances. What's unique about your fund financial statements is that you're not going to see things like long-term debt, and you're not going to see things like capital assets in those financial statements. It's just going to be your short-term current financial resources that will be presented in those financial statements. Okay. How do we get from your fund financial statements to your government-wide? If you flip to the next page at 46 and 47, the GASB requires a reconciliation between the two statements. Okay, so to go from, let's just say, cash basis of accounting to full accrual basis of accounting, you have to do a reconciliation. And for your fund financial statements, we call it modified accrual. That is the basis of accounting you use. We have to reconcile the modified accrual up to the government-wide. And what are the things that we need to add to the government-wide? Long-term debt and your long-term assets. Okay, those are primarily the items that are being reconciled up to your government-wide financial statements. So primarily the reconciling items are going to be capital assets and your long-term debt. And there is some revenue recognition variances as well between the two statements. But overall, the majority of those changes are going to be your capital assets and your long-term debt. Now, the fund financial statements reflect, you'll see that there's specific fund names, general fund, flood control, other public protection, MHSA. Those funds are what we would refer to as major funds. Okay, so the GASB, in their when they came out with GASB 34, they provided some criteria on what would constitute a major fund versus a non-major fund. Now, before GASB 34, it would just be general funds, special revenue funds, capital project funds, and so on, debt service funds, and you'd have those funds in a total. But under GASB 34, they wanted to, hey, let's break out these other funds that meet a certain criteria. That criteria is that they would have to have 10% of total assets or liabilities or revenues and expenses. So they would need to have, their assets would need to exceed 10% of all of the funds combined. Plus, they would also meet a 5% threshold as well. So the general fund is always going to be a major fund, and your flood control meets that criteria, and the rest of the funds are funds that the county has decided to present as major funds. The GASB does allow management who's preparing the financial statements to select certain funds to be major funds, and that's perfectly fine. And then what's left over is the other governmental funds column. And as Kenali mentioned in her presentation, the supplementary information in the back of your financial statements includes all the detailed funds that make up all of these other funds. So you can get the detail of what makes up each of those makes up other governmental funds in the back of your financial statements in that supplemental section.
So, David, when I go through this, you know, I find that it hurts my head a little bit to kind of try to understand the whole thing. It reminds me of when I have to look at construction accounting and understand the WIP schedule. It takes me about 5 minutes before I can do that. One of the things I was noticing here is on, I know that we toss around a budget number now, and I think this year it was about $9.6 billion, and now the budget number, I think, is about $10.8 billion. And I'm looking here in revenue on page 49 of $5.6 billion. So I'm just looking for another $4 billion someplace.
And my appropriations include all the transfers in and outs, and I believe those are taken out of the ACFR because those are just funds. So
So where's the other $4 billion?
A lot of our transfers.
Yeah, and that budget may include the enterprise funds.
Right, and also transfers in and out.
You don't report on the ACRA?
What's that?
You don't report on the other $4 billion worth of funds?
If you go down to the, on that particular page that you're looking at, 48 and 49.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down and look at the other financing sources section, down here, Mark, you're gonna see transfers in and transfers out of about 1.4 billion. So that's
right.
Part of it, because that does become a,
so I get seven, now I'm up to 7 billion.
That becomes a
financial
resource.
You only have to sign me.
Yep.
But you have 2.5 additional billion.
Yeah, I don't know what you're referring to, but
Andrew, does my question make any sense to you?
Well, I've got my esteemed colleague next
to
me.
Right, it is. It's a lot of factors. So the ACFR is reporting what actually has happened, and the budget is what we are, what's planned to happen. And in our budget, we have our transfers in and transfers out. We also have all the appropriations for intra-fund borrowing, for capital projects. That may or may not happen. We have to do a lot of rebudgeting. So I imagine the other two or so, well, two, that's a lot though. But it's...
That is a lot.
Yeah. But there are budgetary statements in here.
Get ready, because Kim, I'm going to ask this next year when it's $3 billion.
I believe in that there's also, you have your budgetary statements also in your ACFR that does compare the budget to the actuals.
On a fund basis.
On each fund.
Each fund has their own budget schedule.
I'll be prepared though. You've asked me that question next time. I'll be like, well, Mr. Wiley, it's done.
I'm going to ask Sherry, how much do we collect per year?
In property taxes,
yeah.
$9 billion, but that's all of the 200 plus agencies in the county. And the
county
portion is going to be that portion of 1.3, which is on the taxes line, plus their sales tax.
I'm just looking at my pie, and it's $9 or $10 billion. I want to make sure all the slices get eaten by somebody appropriately.
Yeah. So I joined the GFOA subcommittee. On financial reporting, it's auditing, you know, all those issues. And one of the things for us is this age-old question, whether there should be a required budget versus ACFR reconciliation. So
there should be.
There should be.
I'm a proponent of it.
Because we don't know what's, like, sorry.
I'm a strong proponent of it, and I've given examples of other agencies where there's...
We don't know where the money goes in the budget, you know what I mean?
So Aggie, you're in the same place I am. So I'm not stupid. I thought maybe I was stupid, because I felt stupid.
We need to know why there was differences, where those differences went, if it was rebudgeted for other purposes. Those are all budget.
So
we want to audit.
So, Madam Chairman, my suggestion is that we might, and I don't think we're voting on anything this time, but that might be something we want to bring up at our regular meeting to see if we'd want to suggest that the supervisors have a reconciliation of the budget to the audited financial statements, because I think knowing, because otherwise...
Like what happened during the budget?
Yeah, I mean,
budget estimates wrong.
Where were the mirrors and the pixie dust? I mean, we are near Disneyland, so.
We have confirmed the budgetary statement in the book.
Yes.
As Dave said, it's
52.
Yeah, 52.
Flip over
it just
page.
Excludes the enterprise, because the enterprise reported that. So that's your delta is the enterprise.
So the GASB allows for the inclusion of a budgetary schedule in the statements only for your general fund and your major special revenue funds. So the first one is your general fund. And so just for the general fund budget, you'll see that at the bottom there, you had about a $5.1 billion approved budget for the expenditure side. And then on the far right column, you have your variance. So the budget schedule is prepared with your original, your final, any changes that were taken to your board subsequent to the original budget being passed.
But this budget is, you know, $4 billion less than the number that I keep hearing tossed around. So I still got the same $4 billion question. And I don't think you have to answer it. I do think it's something that we as an AOC need to decide whether we think that's important. $4 billion.
There are other places. So in our budget books, we always show the budgets and the actuals, and we also have the variances. And also, I believe in your auditor controller budget book as well, you're reporting on your budgets and your actuals as well.
Now, from a compliance reporting, this is what's meeting the requirements for compliance. The county is passing a budget on a fund basis, so each fund has its own budget within the.
And they're obviously passing a budget on some other things too.
May I please add? So what's on page 52 is just the general fund, so it doesn't include the other county funds. Those are included on a separate page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What page is that?
May I add another comment, if I may? Remember, from a budgetary perspective, right, they're presenting what the total appropriations that need from each of the departments and from an operational perspective. But from the after perspective, we have to do gap adjustments, right? So let's say for the general fund, you don't want to gross up the cost to provide operations to general fund. So within the general fund, let's say HCA might bill SSA. So both of those appropriations are included in these two departments' budget. So it makes up a part of that $10 billion. But from a gap perspective, we don't want to gross up the cost within the general fund. So we do gap adjustments. So we'll reduce those transfers in and out to those between those two departments within the general fund or those inter-fund billing to each other. Because there's no point. You're one household. You're one bank account, right? Why are you charging mom and dad? It's in one account. Does that make sense?
And sorry, one more thing. So it's just, there's also on page 73, we do have a reconciliation for the major funds from the budgetary basis to the fund level. But that's just for the major funds.
Didn't I come back there before the meeting and say that was the group that did all the work?
All right. So going back to your fund financial statements on 48 and 49, this is your income statement. So a couple things to point out in your governmental financial statements, your governmental fund financial statements. Your largest revenue sources are primarily taxes and intergovernmental revenues. So taxes are going to include your property taxes, sales taxes that you're collecting. That's a large revenue source. And your intergovernmental revenues are going to be your grants that you're receiving from the state, from the feds, in order to provide the services that you're mandated to provide in the county. So those two revenue streams are going to be your largest revenue streams in your governmental funds and more in particular your general fund. The revenue recognition criteria for governmental funds is different than your full accrual funds. So most of us, you know, if we're thinking we have a business, you know, and if I bill my customers today, you know, I book receivables and I book revenue. And then at some point, I'll record the cash and reduce the receivables when I collect it. For your governmental funds, yeah, we can bill the federal government for the services that we rendered on a cost reimbursement basis. But if we don't collect that within a period of availability, that's the kind of the key term. If we don't collect it within that period of availability, then I have to take that revenue. Receivable stays on the books, but I take the revenue and I reverse the revenue, take it out of income, and I put it on the balance sheet as a unavailable revenue or a deferred revenue, let's say. So we don't recognize the revenue in the income statement. So that's sort of the unique, very unique aspect of fund financial statements. We're only recognizing that revenue if it's available in order to finance current expenditures. The county's period of availability is 180 days.
No, 60.
60 days.
60 days.
60 days.
Days. All together, 160 days. Okay. Yeah, that's right. So that makes it really easy for auditors because I do have clients that are 180 days too, and even 1 year. So that's a policy maker. That's a policy decision that the county makes in its financial statements to determine whether they're going to use a 60-day period of availability to recognize revenue, 90 days, 120, or so on. No, you know, nothing greater than a year. So the county, if the county bills for grants, or it's even for property taxes as well, and doesn't receive the cash by the, you know, come the end of August, then that revenue gets reversed in the current year and goes into the next year. Okay, we still have the receivable on the balance sheet, but we don't get to recognize the revenue until next year. So that is another kind of a unique accounting. That's part of the modified accrual basis of accounting. And that becomes one of those conversion entries or reconciling adjustments that have to be made. Remember, we have to reconcile to bring on the capital assets. We have to reconcile to bring on the long-term debt. And then we have to reconcile to bring on the revenue that we didn't recognize in the fund level financial statements. But we get to recognize it at the full accrual financial statements because full accrual is full accrual. We recognize revenue when we earn it. Not necessarily when we receive it, okay? So that plays some, obviously plays some, that can be challenging from a budgetary perspective in order to budget what revenues we're gonna be receiving going into next year. And but the budget schedule that's on the following page, on page 50, start on page 52, again, this is the general fund budget schedule. Again, it's going to follow modified accrual basis of accounting. So we might have budgeted revenue or taxes of a certain amount, or let's just say intergovernmental revenues of a certain amount, but we only recognized $2.2 billion for intergovernmental revenues, but we budgeted $2.6. Some of that could be because of the revenue recognition factor, because while we earned it, we didn't collect it within a 60-day period, so we can't recognize it as revenue on your income statement, and you don't recognize as revenue on your budgetary schedule either. Okay,
David, I might mention that on the property tax, with having a 99.2% collection rate,
yep,
it makes it much easier because we have the last year the top secured rate in the state. So it does help on that cash collection that we're already at the higher end.
Yep.
When you see the 966 budget and then we came in at 990, it's really a combination. We have the assessor starts the process, the auditor controller identifies all the taxes, and then my role is to bill and collect. But I think that is,
yep,
also, you know, 94-93% of the discretionary revenue,
yep,
that the county has to send separate from the state and federal, which is that intergovernmental. But I think that kind of pulls it together where we are, you know, having that high collection from the team effort from everyone really makes it easier because there's not that much revenue coming in that 60 days, or because we've got a high collection rate.
Yeah.
And then you get us a tip every so often when you run an auction. It takes, when you run one of those auctions for people who haven't paid their property taxes, we get a little extra money in them.
Well, we only auctioned off 7 improved properties in June.
Ah.
But what we do get for any properties that haven't paid, we do earn 18% interest. And that does go right into accruing into that property tax. And so by having a low number of properties sold, which is good, everyone keeps their property. But in that interim, when they're delinquent, they are paying that 18%. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty tough to get 18% unless you're a bank or someone who's charging your credit card people,
yeah,
24%. So there's benefits to the county, but there's also obviously, having to do a tax auction.
Right.
Yeah. Property taxes are, you know, by the time we get to June 30th, there's not a lot remaining to be collected. With two collection periods in the year, and yeah, as Sherry mentioned, by the time you get to June 30th, there's a high collection rate already. But under GASB, it's the same criteria, except This isn't a management decision to make it 60-day period availability. GASB requires the period availability for property taxes to be no more, no less than 60 days. So you have to use a 60-day period availability. So if you haven't collected all your property taxes by the end of August, then all of that would have been swept into an unavailable revenue also.
But could, by that time, since the collection takes January, you know, the,
yeah,
you're not going to have,
yeah,
there's not a, much of a lagging indicator on that.
The grants tend to be the more volatile areas just because you're working with so many different granting agencies. You're working with the feds, the state, and each of those departments at the state and the feds have different policies for when they'll, you know, when they'll wire you the wire you your reimbursement. So so cash flow is an important thing with grant management.
You know, David, I might also mention the executive order came through, and I know the auditor controller and Kim are working on it with my team for having only electronic payments of all of the grants from the federal government. So right now, we were getting a lot of checks in. By having that executive order, it'll be interesting next year to see how much of a difference that makes, because September 30th, today, is the deadline for them to have made them all electronic. So it will be interesting for the risk, because theoretically they should all be electronic payments instead of in the mail, lost in the mail, wherever
it is. Are you advocating for the auditing fee to go down, since that'll be so much easier than
maybe. I think that might be a good option.
The government might shut down tomorrow, so we'll see.
True, That could be another problem with the diary, no question.
56, page 56, kind of going through the rest of the financial statements. This is your proprietary fund statements or your enterprise fund statements. Now, these are your funds that operate on a full accrual basis of accounting. Again, when you aggregate these funds, they make up your business type activities on that government-wide statement that we covered earlier. Okay. So you have your airport, you have OCWR, and you have this compressed natural gas enterprise fund. There's only three enterprise funds for the county. So that makes it very easy, you know, to manage. Of course, the airport and solid waste are your largest funds. This financial statement will look very closely similar to your government-wide financial statement. Again, assets, liabilities, net position, it's a full accrual statement. It's going to have your long-term liabilities. It's going to have your long-term assets reflected on the statement.
Don't they also issue their own ACFRs as well?
That's a good point. The airport and OCWR also do issue their own standalone financial statement. It's just a financial statement, so it's not an
ACFR. Do you perform that or somebody else?
And we audit that as well.
Okay.
Yep. So as part of the audit, we have teams that go out to those different departments to do various audit procedures, and then we do. They do issue a standalone financial statement for those funds. On the far right column, you'll see government activities, internal service funds. Okay, so internal service funds are those funds where the government or the county creates a fund to act as a sort of internal charging out of costs, let's say. So it could be through a cost allocation plan. There's various shared costs within the government, such as your compensated absences, or it could be your risk management program. Also could be where you have a fleet department. And so all of your vehicles that are outlined in that are part of the fleet go into this internal service fund. You can see the detail of those internal service funds at the back of the report, which would start on page 202. So we have things like your health and your self-insured employee benefits, your self-insured health plans, workers' compensation, risk fund, your general liability risk fund, an unemployment insurance fund, transportation. So a lot of these activities are sort of internal. These are functions that are really benefiting the county internally and not really externally. So the idea of having these internal service funds is primarily to allocate costs to the user funds. especially like your risk management, your general liability, and your workers' comp. The county is being self-insured, and so being self-insured, you need to come up with the cash in order to make those payments when they become due. And so there's like, just like your own, and you know, your car insurance or your homeowner's insurance, or you're going to get assessed a premium based on risk. And so departments get a premium assessed to them based on risk. That's part of their budget. They make that premium to the internal service funds. Internal service funds collects those premiums, use those premiums to pay out benefits when they become due. And included in these funds are liabilities that are being actuarially determined by your actuary, who is looking at any potential liabilities where there are unreported claims that are out there that maybe haven't been reported yet. So that gets picked up as a liability. So these funds are primarily collecting cash, collecting assets, paying out benefits, paying out expenses, but it's all internal. It's all county related. Okay, going back to the next page, your fiduciary financial statements, starting on 59, I'm sorry, 61. So we have three types of fund financial statements. We have governmental fund, we have your proprietary fund, and we have fiduciary fund financial statements. So those are the three types of fund financial statements. Your fiduciary fund financial statements are all full accrual. And these funds are basically just how it's explained. They're fiduciary. The county is functioning as a fiduciary in holding these assets for the benefit of other governments or other individuals. So the results in the fiduciary funds, the assets, the liabilities, the revenues and expenses, do not show up in your government-wide financial statements. They're excluded because they do not; these assets do not belong to the county.
Can you say that again?
Yes. The assets, the liabilities, the revenues and expenses of the fiduciary funds are not reported with your government-wide financial statements. Your government activities or your business head activities, they are not included because these assets do not belong to the county. County is only holding these assets in a fiduciary capacity for the benefit of others outside of the county. Okay. And so these fiduciary funds are broken up into four categories. You have private purpose trust, you have an investment trust, you have a pension and OPEB trust, and you have custodial funds. They're all just different classifications or characteristics of the same thing. We're holding assets for other individuals. The funds are going to be more or less classification of who we're holding them for, more so, and sort of the activity of that activity. So investment trust is going to be, you know, we're holding cash and investments on behalf of entities who are participating in the county's pool, county's investment pool, that are outside of the county. Okay, so this is going to be the external pool participants. In the investment trust.
And David, that's all the school districts here and community college districts really owns about 55% of the pool of funds.
Yes. Yep. And your pension and your OPEB trust funds, a lot of activity here. This is going to be OSERs. OSERs is going to be in that column, along with the other pension and OPEB plans that the county administers internally on behalf of.
Is this all OSERS funds or just our portion of OSERS?
This is all OSERS.
All OSERS.
And the reason why OSERS is included in your financial statements is because they meet the definition of a component unit. Because your board appoints their board majority, and the bylaws specify that your board can remove those members as well. So because of that relationship,
But not all of the OSERS funds are for county employees.
Right. This is going to be 100% of OSERS.
County.
This 100% of OSERS is reported here. because you have to report them as
a fiduciary.
We don't have OCFA OCRs in there. We don't have, right?
It's 100% of OCRs is reported here.
It's 100% of OCRs.
Yep.
I'm gonna go back and look it up too.
And you can find that detail, again, going back to the back of your report, you'll see all of OCRs reported in the fiduciary financial statements on an individual basis. The reason why all of OCRs is reported is because of the financial accountability, it's a component unit. So anytime a separate legal entity qualifies as a component unit, we have to report all of it in financial statements.
I confirmed.
Yeah.
David, I have a question.
Yeah.
How come certain asset classes are listed for like the pension and OPEB trust funds, but not like the investment trust funds?
Great question. Yep. The GASB requires this level of disaggregation for these pension and OPEB funds.
Not for the others.
Right. Yeah. And most of that classification is coming from OCRs. They're the ones that are investing in, obviously, these more sophisticated investments that the county would not be permitted to invest in most cases. But yeah, that's the reason why you have all that disaggregation, is because it's OPEB and pension requires that level of disaggregation in those funds. Okay. Again, these assets are not included in your government-wide financial statements. So the idea that they're in fiduciary funds means that, you know, under the GASB's definition of a fiduciary fund, as you go through the process of determining a fund and if it's a fiduciary or not, you know, one of the things is, are we holding the assets? Are the assets protected from other, you know, from creditors? Are they for the benefit of other individuals or organizations? So these assets, again, they don't belong to the county. The county can't use them to finance its own liabilities or obligations. Okay. All right. Let's go into some of the footnotes. I have a few that I wanted to highlight, and then should be about done. Any questions so far on the financial statements? Are you feeling like you're kind of getting a better sense of statements and how they're put together? It's a lot of information, I know. The GASB has done nothing to make this easy for anybody, I understand. Starting on page 63 is where the footnotes come into play. So under generally accepted accounting principles and under governmental accounting standards, whenever you have a set of financial statements, they need to be accompanied by footnotes. Footnotes are designed to help the reader understand what are the significant accounting policies that went into preparing the financial statements. Some of those things that I mentioned already about component units, and what are the component units of the county are spelled out in the notes. Also, there's some discussion about the revenue recognition differences between those funds, where the county discloses its period of availability of 60 days. Just provide some background on the different financial statements that are included in the report. To provide some background of the major funds. Starting on page 67. And the rest of note one is really more policy. Page 75. Now, if you remember on the government-wide financial statement, we were looking at the net position, and I was explaining to you that it's broken up into three different categories. Well, your fund financial statements are broken up into five different categories. Okay, those categories are non-spendable, which means you can't spend it because it's probably not cash. In this case, it's inventory and it's prepaids. Those are not liquid assets. Those are assets that have already been paid for, but they just have not been consumed. Restricted, which is by far the largest category. And you have assigned. County does not have committed fund balance, which is the, another category. Assigned fund balance and unassigned fund balance. So restricted is going to be restricted by laws and regulations and those external parties external to the county. The county can't make that fund balance restricted. The county can't decide that something is restricted. That restriction has to come from something outside of the county, a law, a regulation, a contract, something to that effect. If you get down to the assigned fund balance is going to be the county has made a decision that we need to use these funds for a purpose, and they're assigning those funds for that particular purpose. The county discloses its policy in its financial statements on how fund balance can be assigned. And so according to that policy, these categories were set up to demonstrate that these particular assets are being assigned for that particular purpose. What's left over is unassigned or unrestricted, another way of looking at that. Your unassigned fund balance for the general fund was about $900 million at the end of last year. Note two, and the footnotes are going to be numbered, starting with number one. Note number two is usually reserved for changes in accounting principles or policies that do require some presentation change in the financial statements. Last year, the county did have a change of one of its funds that they moved from a major fund, or they changed it from non-major to major. This year, I would imagine in that category, you might have the prior period adjustment that's going to be related to the compensated absences. Because this year, we are going to be reporting the compensated absence liability in a different manner than we have before with the implementation of GASB 101. So that will trigger a prior period or a restatement of beginning net position. And so I think note two might be where this will be presented this year as well. Note three is your deficit fund equity. And this is going to be the note where any funds that had a deficit, fund balance, or equity are disclosed. The GASB does require disclosure of funds that do have a deficit with management's plans on addressing that deficit. And so there are four funds listed there that do have a deficit with the county's explanation on how that deficit will be resolved. Note four is your cash and investments disclosure. I'm not gonna get into the details, but starting with page 86, go to the next page. This sort of gives you a breakdown of all of the cash and investments that are in the financial statements. The footnote does begin with some explanation on the various compliance components that are overlaying the investment pool. The county's investments have to comply with various government code sections, so that's disclosed. And then when we get to this schedule provides a nice tie-out of where is the cash and investments recorded or reported in the fund financial statement. So if you recall, we looked at the government-wide, your government activities, your business head activities. We looked at the fiduciary funds, those two component units. When you add up all of the cash and investments, it comes out to $42 billion. Now remember, these last two items, the Orange County First Five and CalOptima, they are not necessarily part of the county. They're just required to be reported in the financial statements. And also remember the $33 billion in the fiduciary funds, that cash does not belong to the county. So really, it's these two line items are the two items that have the most meaning for the county of about $5.6, $5.7 billion with your government activities and your business type activities. The cash and investments in these two categories are going to be spread across your governmental funds and your enterprise funds and your internal service funds. Okay. Next page on 88. Right here. And your cash and investments, primarily your investments, are required to be reported at fair value. Okay. So the GASB adopted new fair value accounting several years ago under GASB 72 to mirror what was going on in the FASB reporting world. And so what we have here are the presentation of the fair value of your investments is presented using a level category of level one, level two, level three. So a level one asset is one that you can value that asset. It's readily determinable. You can go today, go right online, and you can determine the fair value of your investment. All of us occasionally, we kind of get onto our broker account or whatever, and we're just trying to see, you know, what does it look like today, right? That's instant, right? But then you're looking at some of those investments in your portfolio, you're like, well, that one doesn't have a value yet. That's because it's probably not traded daily. So level one assets are going to be traded daily. And you can see the county doesn't have any level one investments with respect to its investments. When you get down below, you'll see some that are level one. But as far as its own investments, no level one. Level two are going to be those investments that are not traded daily, but they're traded frequently enough. Primarily going to be your debt securities. Not all debt securities trade every day. And so level two is going to be those assets that that have significant observable inputs, but they don't have daily inputs. They're not actively traded on a daily basis. Level three is going to be those investments that are not traded daily, that really don't have a significant observable input. These are going to be things like mortgages that maybe you're holding. If you own the property and you're holding a mortgage, could be land, could be those types of assets that you'd have to go out and get an appraisal of that property. And that appraisal would only be good for that day or that point in time. Again, the county does not have any level three investments. So this is important because it does give the reader some idea of the level of risk that the county is in with respect to its investments. I would say level three is probably, would be your highest risk. I'm not saying level two is not risk or high risk. It's just kind of your more moderate level. It's where most governments are because of the types of investments that you're permitted to invest in. You're not allowed to invest in the equity market. So all of your investments are primarily tied up in the debt securities, and that's probably the safest area to be in. Then you subject yourself to other risks, things like interest rate risk and credit risk that goes with that as well, which is a whole nother disclosure, and maturity risk that goes with it.
David, I might just mention that, when you look at the balance sheet as you went through,
yep,
you've got cash and investments, which is about 40%, and then almost the other 60% are capital items,
yep,
the long-term items. So yep, really, you a lot of time is devoted, and GASB is definitely focused on making sure you know where that asset, which in this case for the county is a high percentage.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, see, liquidity is an important factor with the investment portfolio, with complying with your investment policy. The rest of the investment disclosures also include OSERs. Again, these are not, they're required to be included, but I am not going to go through any of those. Note 10, skipping ahead, just trying to highlight some of the more important notes before we wrap up. Note 10 is your long-term debt footnote. And I would just go to page 121. Yep, starting there. Keep going up. Keep going up. Sorry, back the other way. Down. Go down. Yeah, right here. Okay, so anytime you look at the footnotes, I mean, there's footnotes that we talked, we looked at cash and investments. There's footnotes that detail out your capital assets. This footnote details out your long-term liabilities. And your footnotes are going to be, you're going to have two different categories in your footnotes. You're going to have one category that's going to be tied to your government activities, and you'll have another one that's going to be tied to your business type activities. Again, these footnotes are to support the financial statements that are in your annual report. Your government activities debt, this is going to be debt that's going to be primarily financed using general fund. General fund is going to be the primary financing mechanism to pay back these liabilities. So these liabilities aren't tied to a charge for service per se. That would be in your business type activities. So more general obligations, certificates of participation, revenue bonds, meaning they're tied to probably a lease revenue instrument. So you can kind of see the different types of debt you have that's adding up to this $5.7 billion altogether. You have bonds, teeter bonds, teeter notes, and then you get into these other categories, compensated absences, you have insurance claims payable, lease liability, subscription liability. The county also includes the net pension liability and the net OPEB liability. So this is sort of an all-in. This is our debt. This is our liabilities or obligations of the county. Not necessarily just your external borrowing, but that's more of the top line, along with some of the finance purchases and your leases. Those are external borrowing in nature. But this is an all-in sort of presentation. This is all of our sort of long-term liabilities that we have. And if you compare different entities, different counties, they do this a little bit different. They could present this a little bit differently. But for Orange County, I like the presentation because it's an all-in. This is what we have. This is our debt, long-term wise, so that you can kind of get a nice one place to go to see, okay, what's my debt today or at the end of the year, and so this gives you a good picture. This column over here is what's due in 1 year. So at the end of June 24, our due within 1 year was about $300 million. Okay. Now, a lot of that had to do with compensated absences, and that number will also change this year under the new accounting pronouncement. But what that is meaning is that the county, more likely than not, pays out about $125 million a year for compensated absences, people who take their time off. That's the sort of the amount that the county pays out. Okay. The next page is the business type activities schedule. That's similar. This is the debt of the business type activities. So one thing you'll notice here is very little external facing debt. Most of it's internal. Your compensated absences, I would say the internal debt. You have a finance purchase liability that got paid off. You have some lease liabilities and some subscription liabilities, you know, very little. Most of it is going to be more internal. You do have OCWR has landfill closure liabilities and pollution remediation liabilities. So under accounting pronouncements, GASB 18 requires that if the county owns a landfill and it's required to legally required to close that and monitor that for the 30-year period, GASB requires you pick up a liability proportionally speaking You pick up the liability on your active landfills on a percentage of completion basis up until the point it's closed. At that point, when it's closed, you recognize the full amount of the liability. And then you have, then you go into, okay, now we have to close it. That liability goes through the cost of capping the landfill. And then you got a 30-year monitoring period after that. And so that also gets accrued for. So the pollution, the landfill liabilities are adjusted on an annual basis based on inflationary factors, based on engineering estimates. There's always technology changes when it comes to the closing and monitoring of landfills. And of course, costs are always going up. But it is one that does get adjusted on an annual basis and is an area that we focus in on from an audit perspective as a significant estimate. Okay. Note 15. This is page 130.
Do we get those reserves from an outside party? Did they evaluate the reserve necessary for that?
For the landfill?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, actually the county, I think internally, is reserving assets.
So the county does their own evaluation.
The county does their own evaluation to determine what the reserve level should be, and then they send that off to, is it Cal Waste or is that just the...
Yeah, there's some state organization that confirms the amount, and I think actually...
I don't know if it's Cal Waste anymore. They used to, they change, I don't know if they changed their name, but yeah, there's annual reporting that goes up to, they want to make sure that you have sufficient reserves in place in order to close that landfill when the time comes and do the 30-year monitoring primarily. And on the landfill, the county, I think legally, let's say restricts the tipping fees, the fees that are collected when somebody takes their waste to the landfill. Those fees are what's securing sort of that that obligation to close the landfill when the time comes due.
And that's a large number, and that is an enterprise fund. There's no general fund impact.
Yep.
On.
What's the, when are we supposed to close it?
I think it's like 28, 29.
28, so fairly soon.
Very soon, yeah. It's filling it faster.
Page 131. Has your construction commitments. So this is another disclosure requirement that GASB requires that you disclose what commitments have been made by those charged with governance, which will be your board. These are contracts that you've entered into for construction projects, and this details out the different projects, the dollar amount of those commitments. And again, it separates it between their governmental activities, the general fund and other funds that are governmental in nature, and then your business have activities. And on the next page, 132, your business have activities, the, you know, broken up between the airport and solid waste, and you can see the different projects that are ongoing with those two enterprise funds and what has been committed contractually for those particular projects. So these are not liabilities, they're commitments. So they're required to be disclosed in the financial statements, but somebody who is looking at, you know, what are the all the obligations of the county, except deferred maintenance, which we don't have anywhere yet. This kind of gives you a picture of what are some of the those long-term obligations that would be coming due at some point based on the different phases of those projects. Page 20, note 21. Oh, actually, note 18. This is on page 138. This is the beginning of your retirement plan disclosure. I'm not going to go through it, but this is just, this is where it all begins. And the county has two different defined benefit plans, the OSERS and then the health plan. And as you can see, this is what you're seeing here is just the county's portion of the liability. Okay? Not everybody, it's just the county's portion, right? Yes, okay. So this kind of gives you a sense, and I think we saw that 4062 show up at another time, but that's the county's net pension liability. Deferred inflows and outflows are pension-related items that are on the balance sheet. Whenever we have a deferred outflow of resource, it's kind of like a prepaid. It says that I made a contribution to the pension plan, but the pension plan hasn't recorded it yet in my liability because of a timing issue. Then I record that on the balance sheet as a deferred outflow. One thing to note is that the pension plan's year end is December 31st, and the county has a June 30 year end. So there's a 6-month lapse. So at December 31st, the county, the pension plan records everything the county contributed up to that point for 6 months, and that's factored into the net pension liability. But starting January to June, those contributions are not factored in, and they'll get factored in the following year. So that those contributions are showing up in this deferred outflow of resources. So that portion of the assets are not in the liability, but they're reflected on the balance sheet as a deferred outflow. So these deferred outflows and inflows are all related. You know, there's several categories that are related more closely to the actuarial valuation. When there's changes in the valuation of your investments, that it can either be a deferred outflow or inflow. The GASB doesn't allow you to recognize that gain loss all in 1 year. You have to amortize it out 5 years. So that all gets netted out within those deferred inflows and outflows. They're just basically deferred accounts on the balance sheet, and we recognize them in future periods. Okay. Page 21, I'm sorry, note 21. It's going to be on page 162. Again, the accounting standards require that you disclose contingencies in your note disclosures. These contingencies are just going to be items that the county, you know, makes an assessment at the issuance date of its financial statements to determine whether there are any potential liabilities that might exist that might require accrual or disclosure in its financial statements. And so the county is just pointing out that the estimated liability for litigations and claims, you know, the county is defendant in various lawsuits, and so the outcome of those lawsuits could be a material impact on the financial statements. But, you know, usually at the date of the financial statements, it's sort of unknown what impact that has. So this contingency disclosure is included. Note number 22 is subsequent events. So subsequent events are things that have taken place after June 30th that may require either disclosure or may require some sort of an adjustment to the financial statements at the balance sheet date. So things like issuing debt subsequent to year-end is one item that usually is reported as a subsequent event. And so you'll see that several of the items are related to that. Last year we had quite a few subsequent events included, but each year, the county will have some type of a subsequent event to disclose, and that is mostly going to be the last footnote of your financial statements where you'll find information on your subsequent events. So last year, we had a few items in there that were related to the airport fire, and we had some items related to the investment pool and some other litigation that was included in there. So this note is going to change every year. It's going to be a different subsequent event every year that will be reflected. But it's important because when you're reviewing the financial statements for the first time, it could be 6 months after year end by the time we get the financial statements to the board and into the public. That subsequent event disclosure is gonna be everything that took place up to that point of issuance of those financial statements. So it's gonna be very current with respect to anything that has gone on with the county subsequent to June 30th that would require some disclosure. And as the reader of the financial statements, you may be interested in knowing, okay, well, going into next year, the county's entered into more debt, or these activities have occurred that put the financial statements in a little bit better context than as of June 30th. Now we're sort of giving it a little bit more of some current context, even though everything else in the report is historical in nature, so.
Right, I noticed that in the subsequent events, you've got, you know, where there's changes in the bond rating, et cetera. So those are not necessarily completely financial in nature.
Yeah.
But they're financial related. One of the things with the airport fire, remind me when we might have a liability there, and when do we post that liability? You know, because if when you're in a position where at this point in time we had no idea, we have more information now. So when do we, will we in the next financial statement post something?
We have no lawsuits filed against us at this time. We're doing settlements and we've been very successful with that. So should we have anything, it would be this fiscal year. September 9th is when it first.
So the settlements would be in next year's financials.
Well, in the actuals, because we're paying now.
Yeah, the actual settlements, but also if it's pretty clear that we are going to continue to make some settlements, we'd estimate for that and put it in as a liability if it's, you know, readily, is the rule known and
probable and possible, yeah.
No, it has to be estimable and it has to have some
probability. Yes.
Yeah, so in 2425, this cap act where we should have some. Are trying to get everything settled by the end.
By the end of
calendar year 2025.
Okay, so shortly, so we'll be in a position where, so excuse me, so it's June of 2025, right? Yeah, and so those will actually be some subsequent events that you'll, if they're large enough.
And there could be some liabilities already reflected at June 30th, because in this type of a situation where you have a catastrophe in this type of nature. County's trying, of course, limit its exposure as best as possible, but the attorney fees still
exist. And to be fair, they want to be fair with those people.
Right. The attorney fees are going to exist, and those are going to be probably accrued for. They may already be accrued for in the risk management process, but yeah.
And we're basically self-insured on that, right?
Yeah.
We were self-insured for the first $5 million, and then our insurance carriers covered $30 million, and then
the remainder. And because I know that from a budgetary standpoint, for different departments, we were concerned enough about it that we limited hiring and other things.
That's a variety of factors. We do have the ability to pay all of our estimated costs for the fire in this. In the 25-26 budget, I have it all set up to pay to settle everything.
That's why we're at 10.6.
That's right. Yeah, about $500,000 of that, or $500 million.
Did a lot of the money go from reserves? Because obviously we don't budget.
It's coming from your budget.
Well, I don't think they're going to get far. It's less than $2 million. That won't put too much of a debt.
We have a plan for being some of it's borrowing, some of it's, we have like,
yeah.
I guess the other question would be, where would it be recorded, liability?
It would be in our ISF. It would be in our liability fund.
So that those internal service funds that we talked about, there's a fund there for property and casualty risk, and that's where that liability will be reflected. So it's estimated. The rest of the report is your supplementary information that we, Canelli went through that, and These are where all your non-major, kind of the smaller funds exist that make up your other funds. And then real quick, I'll go back to the fund financial statements. And that's page 44. I just wanted to point this out to you. So back to 44. So the GFOA, which is the Government Finance Officers Association, so that's not an authoritative body with respect to financial reporting, but the county does submit their financial statements to the GFOA on an annual basis in order to be considered for an award. And I believe the county has received the award for, I don't even know how many years in a row.
18.
29. 29 years.
LA County's on
50. So this will be the 30th year. Going into it? Okay, a lot of pressure.
We should get the 30th.
Yeah. One of the things that the GFOA prescribes is, you know, your fund balance makeup. So if you can kind of scroll down, there we go. So with respect to your fund balance, GFOA, basically their policy is having a fund available or unrestricted fund balance that would be about 2 months of your expenditures, no less than 2 months of your expenditures.
General fund expenditures.
General fund expenditures, yes. Why don't we use the...
Give me a heart attack.
Which would be around 16-17% or so. Or 740 million, I think, and I did the math on that. So when I took your total expenditures on the following page, you go two pages down, keep going. The income statement, one more. Okay, here we go. Total expenditures, about 4.4 billion. So it's just good to point out that the county, your unavailable fund balance was around 905 billion, or million, not billion, million. And so,
905 billion, that was shocking.
What are we doing here?
So you're right around that 20%, 20.5%. So you're actually above the recommendation, the GFOA. This is going into last year. And if you were to include the assigned fund balance, remember the assigned fund balance can easily just be reprogrammed to something else. So including your assigned fund balance and your unassigned fund balance, you're right around 24% is your fund balance, say, what you have available. So meeting that 2 month requirement, you're way above that requirement last year. With a very healthy unassigned fund balance last year. So that is a financial indicator that something to look at on an annual basis is looking at your fund balance, looking at your unassigned fund balance, and using that marker would be 16-17%, or use 2 months of expenditures. Take your total expenditures divided by 12 times 2, and that's kind of what you want to hopefully have in reserve in the general fund on an annual basis. And so going into last year, the county was well above that.
For the benefit of the group, we look at that every year during our strategic financial plan, which we're doing right now. So our numbers are based off of the budget numbers or based off of plan numbers were. So that's why we're a little bit ahead. Our top priority is to make sure.
Okay, it's 11 o'clock. Any questions? All gazzed out.
So I have a couple of questions. One is the in the past, you know, these are the county's financial statements, and I think we've been doing this. We came and we decided that the AOC needed to have this meeting to better understand the financials, because when you try to read them on your own, it's useless. And I think we started doing this, I think it was pre-COVID when we started this. Maybe 6 years, maybe seven, but somewhere in that deal. And, you know, I forget his name, but he had two initials, J.K.? J.C.? J.C.
Squires?
Yeah, he would come and do the presentation, and then the auditor would supplement us. And so, since they're the county's financials, I'm wondering if the county should be the one giving us the information and the auditor supplement us. So it's just a thought, because I think.
Well, because they do the audits, right? That'd be like us presenting, you know, that's like.
Yeah.
The department presenting, because it's the county's, not David's.
Just a.
We appreciate what you do, David, but.
If you do a good job, and it's great for you to be able to supplement, but we. Chairman, we might want to think about that next year.
Because it starts with the budget, right? You did financial plan, budget, and then average.
Probably HCNC, we can.
Just a thought.
Yeah, I agree with that.
As you move forward on that.
We appreciate David and Connolly, obviously, always willing to.
I do think, as we stated earlier, I would think about us maybe bringing up this next meeting, thinking about that reconciliation between budget and actual. Would maybe be something you want to put on the agenda for next time.
I agree, Mark.
Yeah, so that's the second thing. And then lastly, you know, we're in bigger rooms now, we have more people, and we've got more functions. I think it would be a good idea if we could try, we've got microphones for a while, and now we're, so I think having microphones probably would be helpful too. That, you know, the hearing impaired, Andrew can pull his off at the same time I do.
Yeah.
But you know, I just had mine adjusted, so maybe I need to go back for another adjustment. But some people talk slower, softer than others, and so we need to accommodate for all those kind of things, would be my suggestion.
And I have one too for logistics, because we're no longer clerking, and thank you, Valerie, thank you for the board, everything you guys are doing. I noticed we were trying to facilitate like some of the presentation and stuff, and page numbers were off, and maybe there was some confusion with that. We're no longer gonna be doing that. I mean, that's not part, you know, that's part of either the clerk does that or not, or each individual will have to go through. And I just wanted to point that out, it's something we need to move towards.
I think when we got somebody new clerking.
I have staff, I need my staff auditing, I can't, you know. And then also the page numbers of the CAFR word, so that got confused, you know. Anyways, just some logistical things that we're speaking here.
I like how she did take all these notes, but when I presented before, I prefer having responsibility over my own presentation.
Right, and we prefer that too, because, you know, things that aren't related to our department.
It's my mistake.
Well, and, you know, I think we bring up good things, and, you know, every time we do something a little differently, this is a group, just so you know, Valerie, that is fairly oral, right? And they're gonna tell you what they want and how they think it might be better. And we do that, you know, friendly, because we know that these will get better. And as we get people to improve things, rather than not saying anything and then just, damn it, you know, we're really able to move better. And our group has always really functioned where we've progressed in a positive way as we've moved forward. And if you'll take it in that vein, I think.
I do.
Great.
And also just, you know, so, you know, as even though I'm taking notes for the meeting, I'm also taking notes of kind of like lessons learned or right. Ideas to make sure that future meetings, I can make sure that, you know, we're more prepared for those type of instances.
And Valerie, let's be clear, you fully have permission to go the other way and say, you know, when I meant clerking these other ones, they don't do this.
Right, like I was that. Just going to say that.
Yeah,
Valerie's been telling us
how to do it better, because I think we're all pretty acceptable that we're trying to make things better.
Thank you, Mark. No, I appreciate that. No, because Valerie, you know, we would do some additional things that aren't really what we do, and that we take ownership of that. But
right.
But please, you know, we should obviously.
Absolutely.
You're busy. We're all busy. We're reasonable people.
you know, it goes both ways. That's what I want to point out.
Provides a script.
And David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Would have taken the time to do this. Very nice.
Okay, well, that concludes the special meeting of the Audit Oversight Committee. We're now adjourned at 11:12. Our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, November the 13th at 10:30 a.m. So thank you, everybody.
That's good. Thank you, Chair.